So please make yourselves comfortable, and if you'd like to move out and in and make two rows even, we keep encouraging it. No one does it. Maybe tonight. That'll save my voice a little bit. So I have to say that when I thought about this talk this morning, I was thrown into a panic of a particular kind of story that I tell myself about inadequacy. How could I possibly follow James and David? And in working with that story, I got a sense of what I needed to talk about. Because right in the middle of the story was something else that wasn't the story. It was something that was very, very trustworthy. And what I thought about doing then was, well, I couldn't talk about koans, really. I couldn't talk about shikantaza. So I went to the next step, and I'm going to talk about enlightenment. Thank you. Any questions? And one of the people who has been a profound influence on me, although I never met him in the flesh, is our great ancestor, at least the ancestor, and James is in my lineage, Dogen. And Dogen, so we have to, we heard a 21st century Zen master's chapter. We heard a 20th century Zen master, Obora Sensei, through David. And now we're going to go in the Wayback Machine to the 13th century when Dogen lived. But along the lines of some of the questions that we've been working with over the sesshin on these evenings. The 13th century seems like a long time ago, but the things that Dogen's talking about are very relevant to us. And I was lucky enough to be given a translation of one of Dogen's seminal works by a friend who found it by accident. And the work in question is called the Genjo Koan. And many of us are familiar with the Genjo Koan. It was something that Dogen wrote when he was just starting out in teaching, and then he revised it the year before he died. So it's sort of like the beginning and ending of his teaching. He put it first in his great work called the Shobo Genzo, the opening of the true Dharma eye treasury. And I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's long, but I am going to read some selections from it and comment on them. So when we hear Dogen, it's important to hear him through our heart mind rather than through our mind. He's trying to put into words something that is actually impossible to talk about. But he does it anyway, because you have to say something, as Katagiri Roshi once said. So this is from the Genjo Koan. To practice by pushing ahead, meeting the 10,000 dharmas as a self, and witnessing them thus, is delusion. When the 10,000 dharmas move forward and practice and realize the self, this is awakening. Studying the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. Forgetting the self is being awakened by the 10,000 dharmas. Being awakened by the 10,000 dharmas, one's body mind is dropped, and so are those of others. No sign of enlightenment can be found, and this signlessness presents itself continuously. At first, when you seek the truth, you have separated yourself from its place. Finally, when you have correctly transmitted truth to yourself, at that instant, you are the original you. Life itself is enlightenment itself and has many aspects, but you can only see what your present understanding of practice allows. To appreciate the 10,000 dharmas, understand that oceans and mountains may seem round or square, but there are details to still be seen. And there are whole world systems in all directions. Your immediate circles of concern are of no account. What is demonstrates itself right here beneath your feet and in a single drop of water. So you can see why I advised you to listen with your heart mind and not your mind. Sometimes you hear these things, and the mind stops, and then something else arises. Sometimes when we hear these words, there's a touching quality to them. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what I just read, but I also want to take the opportunity to talk about this phrase that he uses here quite a bit, the 10,000 dharmas. Now, we know the word dharma is one of the three treasures, and some of you are going to take Chukai on Thursday night, and you take refuge in the dharma, and it's usually with a capital D. It means, you know, the teachings, the way. The word dharma, actually, in Japanese, it's shoho, which is a term that just means thing or phenomenon. It's and the root, which I looked up once, of the word dharma from Proto-Sanskrit, is what can be held in the hand, what can be touched. So it's very much related to the English word, which comes from Latin roots, attention, which also comes from a word that has the root of what can be held or touched, tantra, which is also the root of the word tender. So there's a quality of meeting here, of being tender with our own experience, of touching. You might remember that James mentioned last night that when we bring attention to the stories, to the thoughts and emotions, when we bring attention to our bodies, to our own experience, we touch lightly, we pay attention, we come right to it. We don't turn away from it. So we do this with this quality of tenderness, of meeting it, of being present with what's so. But as Dogen cautions us, if we try to practice by pushing ahead, that if we really try to force something to happen, nothing happens. We're just putting energy into it. What we do is we sit in shikantaza with our breath, with our koan, if we're working on a koan. We sit in the presence of what's so, what happens to be arising moment after moment. And the 10,000 dharmas, that's a fancy way of saying everything. 10,000 in Chinese and Japanese means a whole lot. So all the things, all the experiences, everything actually arrives at our own door. It comes to us. We make the mistake of this effortful quality of trying to become enlightened. When we have all that becoming enlightened is another story. It's just another thing we're telling ourselves, which we often use for the fantasy of deficiency that David was talking about. Because we make a comparison, we think we know what enlightenment is, and we can't believe that what we're experiencing could be enlightenment. But Dogen tells us over and over that this is it. You know, it's like, what was that Jack Nicholson movie, As Good as It Gets? You know, if you haven't seen the movie, he comes into a psychiatrist's office, his own psychiatrist, where there's a whole bunch of patients sitting around, you know, with all their different stories, essentially, about their deficiencies. And he says to them, what is this? Is as good as it gets. And that's a Zen teaching. This is it. Our life is actually what we've been looking for. But we look elsewhere. We look in the wrong direction. So that's why he says this pushing ahead is delusion. But if we allow the things of the world to move forward, this is awakening. When things come to us, when we simply meet them. I was reading a book recently by Norman Fisher, who's a Zen priest in California, and he quotes Martin Buber, the great Jewish theologian. And when I read this, it was one of those, sometimes you hear words and they just go, whoa. And this was one of them for me. Maybe it'll happen to you, but maybe after I've explained it, it won't. He says, all real living is meeting. All real living is meeting. So we meet each other here, right now. We're meeting each other in this group. We meet each other in Doksan. We meet each other when the servers come around and serve our meal. We meet each other, we meet ourselves on our own cushions. There's also this self-practice that we're continually doing. The meetings are happening all the time. Our usual reaction is to turn away from what is here. And one of the forms of turning away, of course, is with our stories. There's a Theravadan teacher named Stephen Levine who likes to explain practice, a similar practice to shikantaza practice, the process of watching what's arising, or say watching thoughts, is watching a train go by. And the train is rushing by, and all you know is train. But then after a while, you start to see individual train cars. And then after a while, you notice that there's something in between the train cars. There's something beyond the thoughts. And then you begin to wonder, what's behind the train? So this thing that's beyond the train, behind the train, is given various names in Buddhism, shunyata, and samadhi, emptiness, fullness. it's some sort of still point that is underneath all the hustle and bustle of our continuing addiction to making stories about ourselves. And I use the word addiction on purpose because this morning I got to see how I would much rather think certain things about myself because they're familiar than settle into the truth of the matter, which is that I don't know what's going to happen, and I can only meet the moment. When I see that, it's like a little kernel, a little piece of light inside all the nonsense. And that little piece of light is like the sky behind the train. It's like the truth behind the stories. And, you know, if we really are honest, we know that we don't really believe the stories. There's that little voice that we talked about last night saying, come on, you've been telling yourself this all your life. Really, is it true? Are you really a wreck? Are you really a mess? Or are that little seed of doubt, really? Is that really true? That begins to allow you to see in between the train cars, in between the overwhelming quality of feeling like we know who we are. Actually, if we think we know who we are, that's a pretty good sign, at least in my experience, that I'm off base. This not knowing that's surprised in the Zen tradition has this other balanced place of also knowing. We really are asked not to believe in the stories and these machinations of the mind and to see through them to what's actually so. I was telling one of you a story in Dokusan the other day, and I realized I didn't tell the whole story. And it may be relevant here. I realize I'm not talking that much about Dogen. Maybe I am. This happened to me probably about 8 or 9 months ago. I was teaching a meditation class at UMass Medical School, where I work. And it was a big class. It was a retreat day. There were lots of people there. And I was supposed to give the talk. That's a part of our retreat days when people are learning meditation. And I didn't know what I was going to talk about. So I think maybe I remembered this part of the story this morning. What am I going to talk about tonight? And a lot of things had just happened in my life. A really good friend of mine had been diagnosed with a very serious kind of cancer. And then there were the other things that were going on. The war in Iraq was still happening, all kinds of craziness in the Middle East, which continues. It seemed like there was a lot of suffering. And I thought, how can I speak about this? How can I actually say something to the point? So as I was sitting, preparing for the talk, listening to one of my co-teachers leading a meditation it was on being like a mountain. I was watching outside of the room trees blowing in the wind. And I remember back to when I was a very little girl, there was a hurricane that came through Boston, where I grew up. And I was terrified. This hurricane was the scariest thing that had ever happened to me. The lights went out and all kinds of things were, we didn't have water, and it just seemed like everything was falling apart. And then it all stopped. Everything became very still. And my father took me out into the street, and he said to me, look around. And I looked, and there was no more wind. The wind wasn't blowing anymore. And the sky, if you've ever been out in the middle of a hurricane, this is in the eye, but I was a little girl. I just thought the hurricane was over. The sky was kind of yellow, and it was very dramatic. There were no bird sounds. Nothing was happening. And I must have been four years old at the time. And I said to my father, I said, is the hurricane over? Is it over? And he said, no. No. But this is something called the eye of the hurricane. Right in the center of the storm is the stillness. And I said, you mean it's going to come back? And he said, oh, yeah, it's going to come back. But I always want you to remember this. Well, I didn't. I forgot it. I forgot it until that day. Emotional just thinking about it. One of the points of practice is that we already know this. We already have seen behind the train. But we forgot. We don't remember. The Pali word for mindfulness is sati. And it actually doesn't mean mindfulness. It means remembering. It means coming back, returning to the source. So Dogen is asking us to do that. He's saying, when you actually study the self, that is when you confront the story, you see that your job is to not believe them anymore, to, as he says, forget the self. And when that happens, then that's when awakening occurs. Awakening in our school is not a big thing with bells and gongs and drums and you know, lights in the sky and explosions and fireworks. It really goes back to that original teaching. It's a turning about at the deepest seat of consciousness, as the Buddha said. It's just this flip. Suddenly, we get it. And we stop believing in the stories. It doesn't mean that they don't come back, but we continue to experience more and more that still center in the middle of all the craziness. That still center we can return to again and again and again. I'm just talking about it metaphorically. It may be that it appears to you differently as a sort of transparency, as a not buying in, as a recollection, as a way of saying, maybe there's something else. And I'm saying it actually to all of us here because none of you would be here if you hadn't had that little moment at least once. Because why would you sit and sit and sit for days without moving? If you didn't know it, really, this is crazy. Anybody looking in from the outside would really wonder about us. And maybe, well, I know that we wonder about us too. So in that quality of wondering about it, we keep coming back to Sashin. It's funny. Maybe this is your first Sashin. For many of us, we've been coming back a lot. And there's been this sort of taste of not buying into, not believing the nonsense, the limiting stories, to really open to other stories that maybe are a little more helpful. And then finally, to open to what's behind the story. So I love what Dogen says here. Life itself is enlightenment itself. How could it be otherwise? This is already it. Anytime we make up a thing about being inadequate, we have to see through it. We have to look for the still point inside that tells us, oh, come on, you know this isn't true. Why do you keep turning back? Why are you so addicted to this negativity, to this limiting quality? And human beings are. We just are. It's the way we're constructed. We go back to what's familiar. The good news, the unfamiliarity of actually having the condition that we're in now be the awakened life. It's unbelievable. So, of course, I'm not asking you to believe it, but to experience it. And he says, what is demonstrates itself right here beneath your feet. That maybe is the most basic teaching of all. What is demonstrates itself right here beneath your feet. We chant this every day in the Song of Zazen. This very body is Buddha. This very place is the lotus land. Why do we look elsewhere when it's right here? It's hidden. It's disguised by these very compelling self stories. But after a while, we get tired of telling them to ourselves. And when that tiredness arises, then we see it. We see that life itself is enlightenment itself. Finally, when you have correctly transmitted truth to yourself, at that instant, you are the original you. So, any questions? The questioner has two questions.
First, the story is typically life story, but I'm wondering if non-verbal can also be sort of a story or a trustworthy. Sort of you'd almost call it like an illusion. That I've been getting sitting here is this little guy, this little blinker, blinking red, And when I really look at it, it's not blinking red.
What is it doing?
I don't know. I really don't know. But it's blinking red. And so I look at it, and it's not blinking red.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't.
Oh, I think I want it to blink red.
Yeah.
Well, and Jakey, you've had that happen to
you. So, you know, I had a very similar experience today at when was the tempeh? That was that at lunch, the tempeh dish. And it was in the soup, but this happened at lunch when it was served to me. I thought, oh, potatoes. I don't eat potatoes. So I thought, well, I'll just take one spoonful and, you know, deal with it. And it was the weirdest tasting potato. It was, you know, sweet and soft. it took a little while for me to say, pineapple. I don't know if this is what you're pointing to, but reality is actually much more interesting when we stop describing it to ourselves, when we stop thinking we know what things are, and encounter them full on. You know, blinking red lights, who knows? But there's a sort of reliability in a way to the actual sensory experience of seeing, and there's also the filter that doesn't let us see because we're expecting something, blinking red lights and potatoes. It's a funny thing. It's the way our minds work.
I guess the reason I ask this is that it seems like what you're describing is nonverbal somehow.
I think so. It's nonverbal. Yeah.
But it's like still those nonverbal portions.
Oh yeah. Yeah, my experience is that we have an endless capacity for deluding ourselves, and we do it in every way. And did you have a second question?
Yeah, my second question had to do with the nature of awareness or enlightenment when realized. It strikes me as the thought, the verbal description is a nice thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is this intrinsic to that it's like a nice thing? It seems like you experience it and then it's gone. You know, you're off doing something else. Whatever it is, you're no longer actualizing the moment.
Well, like something, the mind's eye opens into this life beyond the constructions. And then a construction arises to explain it to ourselves. Yeah. So this is like this continual back and forth. And sometimes that construction becomes a huge construction, which we even call Zen sickness, where I've had enlightenment. And that means, and then, you know, all you have to do is go home and deal with your family and your dog and your car to know that this, but it's very persistent, that particular delusion. So, you know, again, this quality of being in relationship with each other helps to protect us from that, you know, thinking we know what it is, coming in to the Doksan room and being asked some question that we think, well, I should know this. And it's like, huh? That's a wonderful thing, that movement back and forth. And we do it for each other as a Sangha all the time. I think this Sangha, this Boundless Way Sangha, has this quality of ordinariness. You know, we're just all being human together. So there's no room for that kind of limited story about enlightenment here. At least that's my sense. I don't know.
And there's a different kind of nonverbal story that I sometimes have, and it's kind of this one. Sometimes I get this one. And I get sucked into this.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it can get really subtle. It can just get really subtle.
the wonderful ironies in being that so much of the delusion can create our hearts, our these narratives, these stories. And yet, I find that listening to the three of you over the past few days, listening to the words, brings at times these moments of just fleeting moments of clarity. But and clearly it's brought by words.
That's right, yeah.
And that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And I'd like to thank all three of you.
Yeah, just to say something about that too, the way our brains are set up, we have to tell stories. We're just doing it all the time. It's what makes us human. So it's not getting rid of the stories, it's meeting them, seeing through them, and having the flexibility to change them. So we get to play with the way we construct the reality of Zen together also, the way we construct everything. But we have to know that, you know, this isn't it, the talks we gave. But they're pointing to. And so we can point away, or we can point towards. But we really still don't know. We may be think we're pointing away, and we're really getting it on the button. And we maybe think we're pointing towards it, and we're a million miles away.
Dogen's really good at getting his feel completely misplaced. But when I first heard that couplet, I forget what the translation is that you quoted, but it's something like when the self affirms the 10,000 things, that's delusion. When the 10,000 things affirm the self, that's enlightenment. That just really struck me as the opposite of what I expect. Why is it the way it is? Or why does he say that?
I think it has to do with what Melissa was saying around the. So we imagine that we're separate, and we imagine that what we're looking for is outside us. So all of our activity going out is based on a faulty assumption. So in some way, advancing to the 10,000 things, going out, you know, maybe it's here, maybe it's in this book, maybe it's in you know, some other place, it never can work. And I think, you know, to me, this 10,000 things advance to meet the self, staying at home, you know, sitting without going, without grasping, the whole world presents itself, but only to the degree that I give up the illusion that I'm separate. So as long as I'm working under that delusion of separation, I'm actually maintaining the separation. And then as I step back, there is some encounter with something genuine. Okay? Does that totally clear that up for you, I hope? A little, yeah. Yeah.
I've gone over that already in my own investigation.
Yeah.
I was just hoping for maybe another little tweak. The illusion of separation, I can understand as being
source of the original expectation being contradicted. I guess the thing that puzzled me was the backlog of the 10,000 things themselves being illusory Maya. When I first began reading Eastern thought, there was a lot of that. So when I read Dogen saying that, it ran counter to it. That was my abrupt being caught short sighted.
Well, and one of the, you point, I think, to one of the wonderful things that has always really thrilled me about Zen is the wonderful, insistence that, that seems pretty real. As Melissa said, everything is the ground. It's not like the train metaphor, the danger of that is we think that it's going somewhere else, that it's not this. So one of the things I think in the koan system that's quite beautiful is that sort of you get whipsawed back and forth between the realizing the fundamental nature as unclouded and unobstructed and no differentiation, and then the very particular, the world revealing itself, in the sound of the stick on the floor. So this whole thing is the ground of awakening. This is it. And only when we stop going somewhere else can we be here where it already is.
Another thing that Dogen probably gets difficult with quite easy use of the word self. Instead of saying self is illusory or a distortion or whatever, he's quite likely used the term 10,000 things referring to self.
Did you want to say something in response to that?
No.
Did you want to say?
Wonderful stuff.
Yeah, it's great stuff. It really is. I think we're right. This is the heart of practice. This is the heart of our awakening, I think. For me, that line particularly invites me to consider my projections as I look out into the world. If I'm going out to affirm things, I'm putting names on it, I'm telling stories about these things. And I can create a really nice little cocoon, that protects me from what's real. And if I simply allow myself to be present, the world itself awakens me. One of the interesting things is that technically we don't talk about awakening as an experience. It's what is. And so the pure presence of that moment when I actually am not standing in the way and things are simply as they are, the stick and the Buddha, us all sitting together, that's it.
When things are seen as they are. The thing, one of the things I love about Buddhism, and it's not just in Zen, it's really Buddhism came out of Hinduism, which really did put a lot of value in the non-substantiality of things back in the Buddhist day, 2,600 years ago, and maybe, I don't know enough, probably still does from what I hear. The quote that I quoted before from the Buddha, the turning about at the deepest seat of self, that's from a sutra called the Lankavatara Sutra, and there's another line in it that I really like that I think really says the whole thing in a nutshell. The enterprise that we're involved in here in the Zen world, the Buddha says, things are not what they seem. Now that's the Maya thing.
that's, you know, that don't believe what you see. Don't believe in the stories. Don't believe in the substantiality. That's only half of it. He says, things are not what they seem, nor are they otherwise. And in Zen, we have to put those two worlds together. If we just go into, nor are they otherwise, you know, the mind will tend to hear the stick and go, oh, it's about this. But it's also about not this. It's both together. And that's what Dogen's so good at talking about, too. I mean, it's amazing, actually, that anybody can talk about it and make any kind of sense. But this does make sense in our own experience. It really is true, and it really is insubstantial. And they're both true at the same moment. And really this opening to awakening, opening to the awakened life that's already here, is discovering that that's not a paradox. That's the actual way of life. I didn't translate the word Genja Koan. I don't think I mentioned the translation is by this guy from Ottawa named Anzan Hoshin Roshi, who's a Soto teacher. But you know what koan means. Genjo means something actualizing that's already actualized, something that's appearing that's already here, and it's hard to translate. So it's sometimes the way of everyday life or the actualization of reality. You see all these different translations of it. But that's what we're engaged in here, to recognize there's sort of another paradox, a moving towards something that's already here. So if we only emphasize the moving towards, we're lost. But when we receive and recognize, then we know it's never not been here. We've always been home. There's no horse on a road home. We're already here. It's already present.
Suggested that our brains are wired to tell stories, which creates illusion and maya and get in the way. And we're also wired to be able to see beyond the story.
Yeah, we are.
So
we're wired to go beyond the story.
So we're both given the problem and the solution in the same ball of wax.
Yeah. And you know, just it is okay, yes, yeah. Well, and wonderful, and both, you know, no paradox. The capacity of the brain to hear a rustle in the bushes and create a whole story about a dangerous tiger is what brought us all here in the first place. We wouldn't be here. The people millennia ago who didn't make up a story about tigers, they're dead. I mean, well, they're all dead, actually. But our ancestors were the ones who said tiger. And many of the times they were wrong. Probably there weren't that many tigers. But just that capacity to do it, it saves our life. Mm-hmm. And we have this other, I think that's a wonderful point. We do have this other capacity to not believe in them, to have doubt, to have great doubt. That's wonderful. Thank you.
That metaphor of the passing train is very interesting, where you see that glimpse of light between the cars. But what if perspective is a bit different? And, you know, that light you're seeing is the locomotive's headlight coming at you. And it's not just some interesting passing train. It's, oh shit, a train!
It's a great story. I don't know how to respond to it. But you see how creative the mind is. That in all metaphors, you know, they collapse eventually. They do. They're not good. Yeah. So I don't know. You want to respond to that?
No, I think I think you can play with metaphors and do something by changing the geography. You've changed the point. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we are staring at trains coming at us, but the context for here, I don't care.
Let me skip the metaphor. This concept of, you know, sitting there watching the train is a very benign sort of, okay, I'm just sitting here, I can watch it go by. I'm not affected personally by this train. And yes, it's very nice you can sit here and get detached from our world.
Metaphors are limited. They're only useful for a point or two, and hopefully in other contexts that in the Dokusan room and in other talks, we've been, all of us I think, very clear that passivity and withdrawal is not what we're about, is not what this way is about.
I'm still not being clear.
Okay. Melissa thinks she's got what you're actually asking.
So I'm relating it to the conversations we've had the past two evenings. But sometimes the stories are really, really upsetting and painful, and just smash us all up into pieces.
Yeah.
And what James just said, the practice is not about going, oh well, smashed into pieces. It's going, oh, and weeping and raging sometimes. But there's still this point when we get that even when we're almost in the middle of it, that the practice, that stability of presence, can allow us, right in the middle of it, to find that little point of transparency or stillness or whatever, so that we don't get, you know, the wave may come over and crash over our head, new metaphor, but then the wave recedes. And in my experience, that's always happened. I can do some particular story that really beats me up for years, but there'll be a little easing of it at some point. And because of practice, I recognize the easing of it. And then I begin to doubt it, and that doubt serves in some way. So I don't know if I'm maybe still misunderstanding you, but you helped me make another point, which is in line with what James was saying. This is not about detachment. This is not a practice of being detached. This is actually a practice of being more alive.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not. It's always good to make it clear.
Yeah.
And this is the thing. We only have words to use here. So we're always misunderstanding each other on that level. And yet, we're all here doing the work. We're all here doing the best we can. And that's amazing. And we help each other, even if the words don't always make sense. The spirit, or whatever, you know, something beyond the words. We feel the connection. So thank you. Oh,
Z.
Jeannie?
No, I was way back. I was just thinking of the 10,000 things, but I always interpreted that phrase. But when I go up to the 10,000 things, there's an I that comes with it.
Oh, I think that's true. There's an I that comes with it.
You know, my understanding of that phrase is when the 10,000 things come to me, there's no other way.
Yeah, that's a beautiful interpretation. Let's see if I can stand into the microphone, although I don't know what this is going to sound like on the tape. When I go out to the 10,000 things, that's me going out to the 10,000 things. When the 10,000 things come to me, there's no me for it to come to. Is that close to what you said? Yeah. And I think there's a truth in that.
In that me is the meeting of the 10,000 things in this spot.
Again, we don't want to be lost in the delusion of everything is insubstantial. Never, and we never do that, right? At least you and I don't.
Just to say something about the idea that our minds create stories, but we also have a capacity to see through them. I mean, our minds create stories to give us a sense of control and a sense of what's known, even a painful one.
Yeah.
I'm a depressed person. I can't handle that.
Yeah.
I know what that is. And what I think one of the things is maybe build an experience, right? Is that when the stories fall away, it's unbelievably disconcerting.
Yes. Yeah.
And that why would we even try to move from painful stories to to a place where there's nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm what tells me to do that? You know, and I'm not sure. I guess maybe if the stories get painful enough, you do that.
Yeah. Or you know, I mean, what's been your experience? Have you ever had the experience of stories dropping away?
Yeah.
So is it awful? That's a yes.
No, it's just, it's disorienting. I mean,
it's disorienting. Yeah. 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 It's disorienting, and?
And you don't know what's coming next.
Right. You don't know what's coming next.
The story with the tiger, you know that the tiger's a pounce.
Yeah. Going to get all chewed up.
Get all chewed up.
Are you going to run away? Or are you going to hit it with your club? Or yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, this is one of the reasons that we cling so strongly to the stories, for that sense of control that you're talking about. In the middle of that disorientation, at least my own experience has been, there's something very sweet there. There's something very releasing, unexpected. So there's like that I've learned to value more than the limited quality of the stories, and yet I keep going back to them again and again and again. You know, it's like that story of the famous story of the picture in the newspaper of a baby who's in the arms of a police officer, and the baby is reaching towards this woman who's reaching towards the baby. And you know, it makes you want to look, what's going on in this story? Well, the police officer is taking the baby away from the mother, who's abusive, who tortured the baby. But all the baby knows is to go to the mother. That's us. We cling to what tortures us because it's familiar. And it's also part of the inbuilt system. And there's this moment when we begin to wake up to, wait a minute, maybe I don't have to believe in it. Maybe there's another life. But I don't know what the form is. But then sometimes it tastes like pineapple.
I want to go back to, Melissa, what you said earlier about when we get tired enough of the story. There's a quality of these stories that eventually gets sort of boring. You know, because we've heard it so many times. And even though it's comfortable, it's so boring in there and so lifeless that there's some, you know, like, I'll try something else. And as you said, it's actually quite, it's much more interesting to encounter the world than to encounter my stories about the world, because there's some freshness, there's some aliveness that I feel, that I experience, that we all do in some way. You know, so it's both the cost of genuinely encountering the world is the cost of everything we think we know, the cost of who we are. You know, so hence the this dying. You know, it is letting go of this identity that has protected us. You know, we can thank this. I wanted to go back to the thing about selves, you know, Dogen using self. So the teaching in Buddhism is sometimes called no self. But the real teaching is no fixed self. The self is a part of life. It arises again and again and again. It arises in human beings. It arises in groups of people. It's one of the ways life seems to organize itself. And the self is not a problem as long as we see that it's transitory. It's a temporary means. So we can use, you know, step forward as the self who goes out in the world and does, you know, whatever I have to do. It's great, the self who comes and sits on the cushion. It's just when we get attached to this self. So the self, we function by being born as a self and then letting that self die so the next self can come in.
And I just want to go back to the comment that you made last night in telling the story of facing into this particularly painful story and until it killed you. You know, that this is really exactly what we're pointing to here. There's a death of the old self that occurs in this practice. And you know, it sounds awful, dying to the old self. Except there really is this new birth of a new self. And then we begin to get that, oh, that new self's being born in every moment.
In every millisecond, there's a new self being born, and we just haven't noticed it because we've been clinging to the old self. So sometimes when we really face into these stories and die to the self, as we say, there's a great deal of, as you said, confusion. And there's also sometimes huge grief. We don't want to let go of the old stories. That's who we think we are. And Dave, I think David said last night, or somebody said in response to you, what would we do without these stories? I mean, that's actually a koan. What would we do without the old constructions? It's terrifying and sad. And some people will say, oh man, you know, all my life I've been fooled by this, and will weep. And as if we've wasted any moment. That's the other part. You know, as if it could have been different. As if the amount of clinging that we do is the only amount of clinging we can do. We're all on our own trajectories. And Dogen has in another text, you know, he talks about effort, right effort, that is aligned effort. Not right as opposed to wrong, but aligned effort. And he talks about, it's just like the way a leaf detaches itself from a tree. Everybody's got their own moment when that leaf starts to detach. It's another metaphor, so be careful, because we, right?
Where's the train?
And the tree falls over on her head. So, it's the wind again. And yeah. So, Steve, is it going?
I'm having a hard time figuring out what my question is, which is
good. Yeah, that's excellent.
I think it was something I think that James said. Normally, when I'm thinking about this stuff, it seems to be more about my perception of reality than it is about, you know, the reality itself. I mean, you know, the sticks are sticks and stones are stones. And if I don't make up stories about them and I perceive them directly, then that's different than what I normally do. Right? So there's, you know, something unusual happens when I can let go of the story. But for some reason, something that James said, it was like more about the thing, you know. I mean, if you perceive the thing as it actually is, then I don't know. I'm confused.
And I'm sure it was David who said it.
No,
let him out with that.
Yeah. He's my teacher, man. he gets a certain latitude. I think, you know what? Oh, Steve, don't worry about making sense. Or worry about it. Go ahead, worry about it. What I'm hearing in what you're saying is, one, how difficult it is to talk about it. It's really impossible to talk about it. And you're describing something that I get a sense of as you make your attempt to describe it, which is all we can do. There is something that we perceive when we actually perceive the world as it is. And it really is like what Dogen describes. Things really do come to us. And there's this thing that happens. So I don't know if that's what you're talking about, but I certainly heard that in what you were struggling to describe.
It's the thing, like James said, it's not an experience.
Yeah,
It's reality as it is. You
yeah.
know? But to me, it looks like an experience. I mean, you know.
It feels like an experience.
Something happens,
right.
You know, and there it is, you know, and that's an experience. It's not...
Yeah. Right. Well, to some degree, everything's an experience. I mean, you know, we have our six senses. Everything's mediated, and yet we survive and live in the world. And so, there's some trustworthiness to what we get from our sensory experiences, even if they are mediated. The just as it is for us, as I experience it, is for a moment, not telling a story about it, just letting it be. And there's this kind of cascade of noticing that happens, that all of a sudden I can notice that the differences among us are conventions. You know, they're useful, but but they're actually the product of stories. And reality becomes this other thing at that moment. And it ends up informing the rest of my life because I'm hardwired to tell stories. And so I, you know, come back. Actually, one of the more interesting things I discovered is that after having this moment, it's easy to create a story that simply incorporates it. And it can, in fact, be a very dangerous place because there's Zen sickness and all sorts of, you know, what's the story of the devil and the person walking down the street and they see a woman who picks up a little piece of truth and the guy says, "Aren't you worried?" And he says, no, they'll turn it into a belief like that. So we continue to practice to come back to this moment of pure presence to turn into the stories that we live in, to come back to this moment of our story, unmediated experience, to do it again.
Kind of in my experience, I've had situations where you brought me up on some of the stories that I was telling. And I realized that when I stopped telling stories, I have to pay attention. That if I don't know, when I know something, I don't pay attention. I already I already know it, so my attention isn't there. When I don't know what's going to happen, what the encounter is going to be, then I have to pay attention to that.
Yeah.
Fully present, because I don't know what's going to happen.
When we stop telling stories, we have to pay attention. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I'll just say there's a word that we often use in Zen. We use the English word intimate a lot, you know, about this meeting quality. The word in Japanese is mitsu. It also can mean hidden. There's this quality of really this tender paying attention to the world beyond the mediation of stories, which is intimacy. It's there's no longer anything between us and the world. That's what we're pointing to. And that's what the promise is. Even though things drop away, there is this sweet intimacy that arises and in amidst all the terror of the new world. And I have to say that in my experience, that quality of intimacy is completely trustworthy. Completely. But don't believe it until you experience it or encounter it or until it arrives for you. So thank you.